You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Gore Vidal was a firebrand, provocative, prickly, and sometimes he could get kind of petty. But his literary output was both impressive and groundbreaking. And yet, despite his memoirs and a number of biographies, we still know very little about his private life, which is, of course, the way Gore Vidal would have liked it. Tim Tiemann, the former U.S. correspondent for the Times of London, has written a book called In Bed with Gore Vidal, Hustlers, Hollywood and the Private World of an American Master. It is published by Magnus Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Tiemann to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
You write that there were many Gore Vidals, all the author's own inventions. Did you get the sense that he was a man who wasn't particularly comfortable in his own skin?
Yes, I did. I spoke to his close family and some of his friends, and I found that there were different Gore Vidals depending on the situation he was in. And certainly in terms of his private life, which he liked to keep extremely private, he would only show parts of himself to certain people at very certain times.
And he kind of was a mythmaker about himself, wasn't he?
Absolutely. As you can see in his memoirs and what he contributed to other people's biographies, everything that Gore wanted to say, he liked to keep under very much control himself. He did not like... If he had a sexual myth to create about himself, it's very palimpsest, his memoir. What he wants you to know is there. What he doesn't want you to know is kept very much away from the page.
So in talking to all these different people and reading him, did a consistent image of Vidal ever emerge for you?
No. No, not a consistent one. A surprising one occasionally. A tender one, which was not the image of Vidal I had in my mind. I interviewed him once in 2009 for the London Times, which is where this book came from, really. And he was on grand Vidalian form that day, zingers coming thick and fast, withering tone, very down on America, not brooking any foolishness in his own fashion. And so when I spoke to his friends and his family, it was interesting to find the sort of man away from the page, somebody who did enjoy Hustlers, who was a partner to Howard for 53 years, Howard Austin. That was a surprise. I wanted to find out who...
Well, he was with Howard Austin, but yeah. He would tell people they hadn't had sex for many years.
Isn't it funny that what people, if they know anything about Gore Vidal's partner of 53 years, what they know is that they know that Gore said, well, we didn't have sex. And in fact, I devote a whole chapter to Howard in the book because I really feel that he's been very ill-served by Gore in a sense. He kept the Gore Vidal show on the road for 53 years. And was his partner and his lover and his boyfriend. They may not have had sex for a long period of time in that relationship, but they were partners. And for Gore to talk more tenderly about a boy in prep school called Jimmy Trimble, which he did do, one of his great sexual myth-making exercises, I wanted to redress the balance for Howard slightly in this book.
I'll come to Jimmy Trimble in a moment. But during the interview you have with him, he told you he was proudest of not killing anyone despite being tempted.
Yes. That's right. As I say, the zingers kept, it was an hour long in his favorite London hotel. It was astonishing. He claimed that America was rotting away, that he wished he hadn't supported Barack Obama for president. This was in 2009. He said, I should have supported Hillary. She'd be better with a Navy. I said, how do you feel about gay marriage? And he said, I don't have any feelings about it at all. Americans are far too stupid. They don't know the difference between the sun is made of yeast and the sun rises in the east. So, I mean, it was just one thing after another.
Well, early in the book, you ask, in essence, and here, imagine the most withering of curled lips from the master himself, how gay was Gore Vidal? Is that a question Vidal himself would have been able to answer?
No, he was very down on all categories, as you said in your introduction earlier on. He believed in gay sexual acts, he said, not gay people. That was his big thing. So he never came out. He never said he was gay.
Why do you think he was so opposed to gay identity?
I think there were two things. In Palimpsest and all his writings, he would make it very much to be an intellectual case. He said that he didn't intellectually believe in categories of any kind. He once said he was bisexual. I didn't really find much evidence apart from some fumblings as a young man of interest in women particularly. But intellectually, he really didn't believe in categories. I would also suggest that here was a man of a certain generation and a certain class who was also in retreat from that kind of definition.
But do you think he was also saying things like that to be provocative? Wasn't he notorious for saying things that would get people's ire up? For example, the claim that he made that FDR knew about Pearl Harbor, the attacks on Pearl Harbor in advance, and welcomed them as a way of getting the United States into World War II.
You're absolutely right. He was a master provocateur. In my interview with him, at one point, when he says he's turned his back on Obama, he raised his fingers in a pistol shape and imagined Obama being assassinated in front of me. So you're right, he knew exactly when to hit, and he knew exactly what headlines to get. But having read his writings around this, his writings around sexuality, which is really the focus of my book, remain consistent. I mean, his point of view around this remains consistent as post-Stonewall happens, as the AIDS movement happens, as civil rights for gay men and women become really a big part of a political landscape, the culture wars of the 90s. He has nothing, absolutely nothing to say and nothing to do with them. When he's asked about this, he says he doesn't believe very strongly in categories. Now, in my book, I talk to his friends and his family, and they paint a very different picture. They say here was a man in retreat, in nervousness around this issue. He felt he'd written one of the great post-war gay novels, The City in the Pillar, right? Now, he felt, this was it when he was 23 years old in 1948, he felt very strongly that that book had made him, but it had also defined him in a way that he was extremely uncomfortable with. Here was a man whose ultimate ambition for a number of years was to be president. I mean, that's what he was truly, truly wanted. And when that wasn't happening, he ran for office twice, failed both times. On both those occasions in my book, I show that he felt his sexuality and rumors and talking about and being asked about and even being addressed tacitly was down to his losses in both those campaigns, actually.
Well, he's caught in a weird bind. He is obviously gay and openly gay in his writings. And at the same time, he's coming from a world where everybody expects you to be closeted. And he seems to be wanting to play both games at the same time.
Yeah, he wants to have a key role in some... I mean, he writes essays around sexuality and sexual orientation and the need for openness and freedom of sexual expression, but he himself never wants to say those words. He has no time with it, no truck with it. One of the best interviews I came across with him was with Larry Kramer, who asks him the question that a lot of gay men and women want to ask Gore Vidal, which is, what is your problem here? And Gore Vidal says, I simply do not believe in the categories that you set out, Larry. And Larry says, but you're a gay man. You've been living with a man, this is in 1992, for the last over 40 years. And he says, I just do not believe in what you say. And then he says, they have very good dessert here. Cuts him off.
The City and the Pillar is the first post-war book to deal with a gay relationship. It was a bestseller. How does knowing more about Gore Vidal's private life, especially his relationships, help us understand literary works like that?
Well, we can see where, in those years, in New York certainly, he was having lots of sex. He boasted that before he was 25, he'd had sex with 1,000 men. He says this in Palimpsest. So he enjoyed sex. He had lots of hustlers. The world described within The City and the Pillar, which there's a kind of homosexual underworld, but there's also glamorous Hollywood gay men, is a world not unfamiliar to Gore Vidal. The City and the Pillar shows us a very fraught relationship, one of power dynamics and power games. The original ending has one of the men killed, and in an adapted ending, he is raped, and the Gore character, as it were, leaves and leaves him be. It's dedicated to Jimmy Trimble, to go back to that issue, which
he died during World War II.
That's right, he died at the Battle of Iwo Jima. Yes.
Do we have any idea of what the real relationship was between the two? Jimmy Trimble had a fiance, and Gore engaged in a feud for decades after he died in Iwo Jima.
Absolutely. The fiancé said, Gore, you've essentially, in much stronger language, which I won't repeat on radio, Gore, you've co-opted the memory of my fiancé. He never loved you. He always loved me. You've blown this up into something it wasn't. Now, certainly a lot of his friends and close family agree with this interpretation of Christine White, Jimmy Trimble's fiancé, that the relationship, whatever it was with Jimmy Trimble, this boy he'd known in prep school and who becomes a focus of his romantic imagination and romantic longings in his books and later in Palimpsest, his memoir, wasn't as deep and enduring physically as it became. But what I can tell you is that in Gore's house in the Hollywood Hills, I saw this when I went there myself, Gore kept a portrait of Jimmy on an upstairs landing, and very late in his life, in fact, in the last couple of years of his life, he would take his chairlift, his stairlift up the back staircase and stop at the top of the stairs and look at this portrait of Jimmy for long periods of time in a reverie. So whatever people think about whether they did as much sex as Gore writes about, Why on earth did Gore continue this romantic fascination, you know, for an entire lifetime after Jimmy's death? It certainly was extremely real in whatever way that Gore saw it as, right at the end of his life.
I wonder how Howard Austin saw it.
Well, Howard would make, this might make you laugh, Howard would make a garrotting motion behind Gore's head whenever Jimmy's name came up. Or he'd say, basta, basta, enough of Jimmy Trimble, Gore, enough of Jimmy Trimble. And part of the book actually looks very much at the last 10 years of Gore's life, which is tragic and very, very sad. It wasn't consistent. He did do public events in the last 10 years. He was out and about, but the general trajectory of those last 10 years after Howard Austin's death in 2003 is drink, dementia, feuding with friends, losing friendships, feuding with family, accusing family of awful things which weren't true, accusing the people who were taking care of him of awful things which weren't true. One of the unintentional things I ended up doing in the book is looking at, for the first time, the last 10 years of Gore Vidal's life.
So I shouldn't take it personally that after we had a fairly friendly relationship, the last time I saw him was a rather unpleasant one.
Was that in 2009?
Yes.
Around that time? In 2009, he publishes his last book, which I think is when you interviewed him, which was Snapshots in History's Glare. Mm-hmm. It was a book of photographs. Ironically, again, for Howard Austin, Howard helped him curate those pictures, and a lot of them are of Jimmy Trimble. Howard's death really marked a huge decline in Gore. He drank, he cried in front of people, as I reveal in the book. His nights were spent listening to CDs of Howard singing Howard's favorite song, Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered. He did love Howard, but he never expressed this to Howard. So it was in the last 10 years after Howard's death that this becomes apparent. You shouldn't be offended at all. When I interviewed him in 2009 in London for the London Times, he was on Gore form, but there were not many smiles, and you'd known him for a long period of time, and I felt a very chill wind that day.
My guest is Tim Thiemann, a journalist, author, and broadcaster who worked for many years at the Times of London. He's now written a book called In Bed with Gore Vidal. That's not literal in your case.
No.
Hustlers, Hollywood, and the Private World of an American Master. Despite publishing this landmark book about the gay experience, you're making the point that he felt uncomfortable, maybe even ashamed by his own sexuality. You would have thought that since all of this was happening, he's kind of coming out around the time of the Kinsey Report, that he might have felt differently. And then there was the example of Oscar Wilde.
Absolutely. Well, he knew Kinsey. Kinsey had done sexual research in the bar, the Astor Bar in New York, which is a famous gay bar in the late 40s, early 50s, where Gore used to hang out. And so Gore knew Kinsey and was very proud to know Kinsey. There's a duality in Gore. You read his writings and he writes about these things, but he will not come out and he will not reveal much about love or emotion or Howard. I mean, Howard is the real mystery, I think, on the page when you think about Gore, actually.
Well, do you think that because he grew up in a very privileged situation, his grandfather was a senator, his father was an aviation mogul, one of the founders of TWA, that he could take risks, write about gay themes, despite from what I understand, the disapproval of his mother?
Absolutely. Yes, he had a very complicated relationship with his mother, which ended very, very badly when she significantly turned on Howard and Gore banished her. Yes, you're absolutely right. Gore loved power and privilege, and he knew he'd been born into that.
And he talked about it all the time.
Absolutely.
He would say, when I was with Jack Kennedy at such and such a place at such and such a time, always liked to tell those stories, always liked to remind people that he was a descendant of Aaron Burr.
Absolutely. No, he wrote about it and spoke about it all the time, and he would boast about it. He would say he was from this political lineage. Power, access to power, having power was extremely important to Gore. One of the more interesting theories that one of his friends advances in the book, when we talk about his resistance to saying the word, to taking a more openly campaigning stance on gay-related issues, is for Gore and men of that generation, gay meant without power. It meant powerless. It meant being a flamer. It meant being a fag. It meant being a sissy. It meant a whole bunch of things that Gore Vidal did not see himself as. So he was in a very odd position because by nature he was a radical, a maverick. He would do as he wanted in absolutely every area of his life, whether it was public speaking or having sex. He had control. That was what Gore Vidal was about. But being gay, this thing called gay, was not what he was in his mind. And that was one of the big dualities, I would say, for him.
So Oscar Wilde would not have been a role model.
No, I don't think
despite
so.
Despite the fact that he loved to make similar kinds of witticisms.
Well, and also...
Not as good as Oscar Wilde, by the way.
Yeah, I think they were... Yes, let's not bracket them too closely together. But I think what they shared was a radicalism and a sense of being a maverick. They did share that, but Gore wanted power, and Gore wanted access to power. I mean, there's a great scene in the book where him and Tennessee Williams are out with Jack Kennedy in Florida, and Tennessee Williams says, "Wow, get the ass on Jack Kennedy," and Gore says, "You are now cruising our future president. Would you please not do that, Tennessee?" And, you know, there are all these wonderful moments where his sexuality does erupt through, and he spends a lot of time with gay writers of the age. A recent book called Eminent Outlaws by Christopher Brown rightly places him as a key fulcrum of gay writers, but call him a gay writer and a bolt of lightning would come down and strike you.
He also coined the phrase heterosexual dictatorship, so he must have seen sexuality as somewhat political.
Absolutely, and there's a whole chapter in the book I devote, because I was very interested to know, well, okay, he had this strange split idea, but right from 1965, so what, 4 years before the Stonewall riots, Gore Vidal is writing about complete freedom of sexual expression, the eradication of anti-gay and sexually repressive lawmaking, and this remains consistent. And when there are homophobic essays in the press, Gore Vidal heads into print and blasts away. He himself just never says the word.
In fact, he goes a little further. In a 1965 edition of The City and the Pillar, he wrote in the afterword, "I decided to examine the underground homosexual world, which I knew rather less well than I pretended."
Well, that was rubbish.
"And in the process, show the naturalness of homosexual relations." So why is he doing that? Is he just being coy?
Yes, he is being coy. He knew the homosexual underworld very, very well. He met Howard Austin in a bathhouse in 1950. And, you know, this is where the ridiculous "we didn't have sex" thing begins. So, Gore Vidal knew very well and enjoyed very much what he called the homosexual underworld as well.
On the other hand, this resistance to categorization, I could see where somebody who wants to be taken seriously as a thinker and as a writer might be afraid that every book that he writes is going to be put in the gay section of the Barnes & Noble.
Absolutely. Although, you know... we wish that the gay section of Barnes & Noble had been around when Gore Vidal was having his career, the majority of his career.
But you're categorized right. As a gay writer.
Yeah, you're right.
At that time, a homosexual writer.
Well, for him, gay meant without power. It meant being on the margins. It meant everything that he wasn't. He liked his proximity to the Kennedys, and when that ended, he liked his proximity to Liz Taylor, to Princess Margaret, to Paul Newman, to Joanne Woodward, to the Hollywood glitterati. He liked all that. He didn't want to be fenced off. You're absolutely right.
What about the public arguments? Did he enjoy those as well? The ones with Truman Capote, Norman Mailer, and of course the most famous being with William F. Buckley, who called Vidal a queer on live television.
Well, this is the interesting thing. When you look at Vidal's career, there are key moments where, despite his resistance to categorization, the gay thing just is the pivot at that particular moment, where you've got The City and the Pillar, 1948. And then, as you say, for your listeners, I'm sure, and for a lot of my friends here in America, they remember the moment where Buckley calls him a queer on television, because that word has never been used before, and certainly not in that way. And Vidal, in that clip, is the one staying absolutely cool. It's Buckley who's becoming more and more choleric. So it's really interesting. You're absolutely right that he, as much as he resists it, there are these moments where it just breaks through. Now, when you talk about his feuding, he was never happier than when he was fighting. He absolutely loved it. And in the book I sketch, I mean, the Buckley legal battle goes on for years, literally.
Well, Buckley
years.
Kept a file on him.
He did. He did. And marked Vidal legal, which Christopher Buckley, his son, then wrote last year he put in a dumpster. And Christopher, unfortunately, wouldn't be interviewed for the book. I'm still fascinated to know whether that file contained what Gore was worried it contained.
Now, why do you think that Gore was so happy to be involved in these feuds? Is it because it brought out the witty side of him?
No. I think he felt under threat. I remember when I was really reading about Truman Capote and other writers, Gore didn't like his throne being challenged in any way. And I know, even with his friends, when you read diaries of Christopher Isherwood or if you read Tennessee Williams, these friendships come freighted with rows and squalls. And I sense that Gore was professionally extremely ambitious. And I don't think he liked I don't think he liked the sense that he was ever going to disappear from the national conversation. Now, these fights with Buckley and with the others obviously helped keep him in the cultural mix.
He was brutal in his critiques of conservative leaders. I would have thought that going after Ronald Reagan for his inaction on AIDS would have been right up his alley.
Yep, he had absolutely nothing to say about AIDS. One of the big things I looked at in the book.
Despite having a nephew who HIV positive?
That's what I discovered, yes. When I was looking at Gore's archive at Harvard University, I came across these astonishing letters and cards from Hugh Steers, who was Gore's nephew, who died of AIDS and who begged Gore in these notes to get involved, to have a voice. This was a critical time in America, the 1980s and 1990s. Not much funding, not much attention being given to this, especially in the Reagan era. But Gore had absolutely nothing to say about HIV and AIDS until, after Hugh's death, I found one thing, which was this wonderful testimonial to Hugh that Gore himself didn't deliver at Hugh's funeral. Somebody else did. I think Burr, Hugh's brother, did. But it's an absolutely beautiful memorialization to Hugh. And in the last few lines to other people who've died of AIDS. But somebody explained it to me. I said, well, what was Gore's AIDS problem then? And again, the problem here was Gore Vidal's interests were history and they were empire. And the theory is really that Gore had no interest in these sorts of things. And again, for Gore, these were fringe or not for him. And as you say, he could have, and as I always felt when I was researching this, as Hugh said to him, you could do something here. Your voice here could mean something.
Do you think it really would have made much of a difference if he'd been more vocal?
Well, when you look at Gore in action on television in primetime, an era of American television and broadcast where thinkers like Gore were welcome on those shows, yes, I think he could have really made a huge difference having that voice. Yeah.
Now, he once wrote, I'm exactly as I appear. There's no warm, lovable person inside. Beneath my cold exterior, once you break the ice, you find cold water. Do you think that was just the image he wanted the world to see?
Or yes,
was
absolutely.
This good self-analysis?
No, it wasn't good self-analysis. Certainly, as you discovered and some of his friends discovered later in his life, when he turned, as we should call it, or when he was angry, you really felt the sharp flick of the tail. But certainly off stage, as it were, he was tender. There are some lovely stories in the book. I found Howard Austin's sister, Arlene Rheingold, who told me lovely stories about Gore being a wonderful uncle, as it were, to her two girls, and a good son-in-law to Howard's parents, who would give him chicken blintzes to take around on his European book tours and things like that. So, and he was warm, and Howard actually was one of the people who could prick that enormous balloon of pomposity and egotism.
Well, there are a lot of contradictions in Gore Vidal. He's a gay man who claims gay people don't really exist. He is constantly railing against the establishment in his writing, but then he cozies up to everyone in the establishment, and he's proud of all of those people, his connections to all of those people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in the book, I was very, very keen to keep all these contradictions intact because they are all true. They are all true. And he lived every one. The interesting thing I hope about the book is it reveals the color and the detail behind the contradictions. But there is no escaping, however much we these days especially want to categorize people and want to put people in neat boxes, here is one enormous figure in the cultural and political landscape who refused that concertedly. And in some ways, I would suggest for gay men and women, would, if they want to find something heroic in Gore Vidal, this sense of maverickness, this sense of radicalism, this sense of never wanting to be typed, maybe that set the ultimate example to us. Even if he wasn't around, it didn't have much to say about the key fights of the gay contemporary age.
Tim Tiemann's book, In Bed with Gore Vidal, Hustlers, Hollywood, and the Private World of an American Master, is published paperback by Magnus Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much, Leonard.